As adults, we know what happens when birds and bees do their thing in springtime, right? But for some reason, this is the spring of dying bees, which leads us to ask, where would we be without the bees?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Folks, it's called Colony Collapse Disorder, or CCD, and it describes what is happening to our population of domestic bees. How bad is it? Some of our domestic beekeepers are reporting declines of 50 to 90%. This leads us to ask, where would we be without the bees? Welcome to the Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phone. Hello, Carol.
Hello there.
Folks, it is bad this year for some reason, and we're wondering where would we be without the honeybees. And here to help us find an answer today, we have Dr. Eric Musson from the University of California, Davis. And also, Dr. Musson, are you there?
I am, sir.
Hot dog. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Bee Central, right? UC Davis?
Excuse me?
You're Bee Central there, aren't you?
Oh, I have been recently, yes. It seems there's quite a bit of interest in this topic.
Yes. Also, California is kind of Bee Central this time of year, is it not?
Well, we had close to half of the commercial colonies of honeybees in the United States out here in February. They're beginning to go home now. For almond pollination. Mm-hmm. That's true.
So it's kind of bee central. Let me ask you a quick question before we go to our next guest, our other guest. To what extent does California agriculture depend on the honeybee?
Well, we have 50 crops out here in California that have to be pollinated by honeybees. And then I guess across the country, if you add the others from other places, it's a little under 100 crops that require pollination by honeybees in order to set the seed or make the fruit or make the vegetables, depends on what it is. So the bees are very, very important.
We're talking 100 crops?
About that. That's what...
What's left?
Things that don't need it, like corn, wheat, potatoes, lettuce. Some of those things don't need bees.
Okay, good. Also with us today, we have Dr. Jim Amrine, who's an entomologist from the West Virginia University. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. The name is Amrine.
Amrine.
Yeah, it's German. It means on the Rhine.
On the Rhine.
And hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing fine, thanks.
And I'm very happy to be here.
So, West Virginia University, so you've got bees out there too, right?
Yes, I've been teaching beekeeping since 1978 here at West Virginia University. And we're in a part of God's kingdom that's almost heaven. You've probably heard that before.
Almost heaven, West Virginia.
You can play that song in the background if you like.
Okay, let me start both of you gentlemen out with a real basic question. You know, we city people really sometimes just lose track of where our food comes from. We were talking with Eric about how over like 100 crops are dependent upon the bees. So the question is, why should we city people really care about what happens to honeybees? I mean, really, food comes from the supermarket, right? Why should we care about what happens to the honeybee? Eric, start with you.
Well, the food ends up in the supermarket, yes, but I mean somewhere the bees are involved in approximately one-third of what we eat on a daily basis. And it's the important one-third, at least in the eyes of the federal government, when they put out that new food triangle. It's the vegetables and the fruits that, and in one case, almonds, and that we really rely on to bring us our nutrients, the vitamins, the minerals, and the very important stuff in our diet. And honeybees are what put it there.
Jim Amrine, anything to add to that?
I'll be glad to. Right here on my laptop, I'm looking at an article published in Das Spiegel by Herr Professor Dr. Günter Lotsch, and it's our GM crops killing bees. Now, we want to be very careful. We don't accuse anybody or anything of killing our bees,
mm-hmm.
But he quotes Einstein here, making this statement. It's a famous statement. It says, if the bees disappeared off the surface of the globe, then man would only have 4 years of life left. No more bees, no more pollination, no more plants, no more animals, no more man. That was a quote of Albert Einstein. Now, he was a very excellent physicist, and we can't say that's absolutely true in the case of bees. But it does give us pause for thought.
And that's why we ask the question, because, again, you know, we city people tend to lose track of the importance of the real things that matter. And, you know, we appreciate bees as they buzz back and forth from our flower garden, from one flower to the next. But they are really very much more important than something that's decorating our garden. They're responsible for almost one-third of the things that we eat. And as Eric says, the important one-third. Let me ask both of you this. What about native pollinators? We're talking essentially today about domestic bees or bees that have been domesticated to kind of do the work for us. You know, we put them to work much as we would common laborers. You know, here, go do this, here, go do that. But what about relying on wild pollinators or native pollinators to do the work of domestic bees? Eric, do you see that as a legitimate possibility for California agriculture?
Well, the non-apis bees, as we call them, that are not honeybees, yes, they are good pollinators. And if it happens that an individual creates a farm on the edge of a meadow near a woods or something like that and doesn't make it too expansive, I believe that the commonly occurring native bees would probably be able to come over and pollinate that crop and make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of trying to get a whole bunch of them together at one time at one place and then take them out into our huge ag fields where we do most of our commercial agriculture, at least at this point in time, we haven't been able to do that very easily.
So it would work on smaller farms set against natural environments, but
yeah, the big thing there is the habitat. They have to have the right place to live, and that's one of the reasons we don't see so many of the native bees around anymore.
Because there's no natural habitat.
Sometimes the plants are gone, but the places for them to nest just mm-hmm. aren't there anymore.
Jim Omrine, what about Almost Heaven there in West Virginia?
Well, it's funny you asked that question. I have a graduate student who's working on a little bee that's called Osmia cornifrons, a horn-paste bee.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that species here. We've had it for the last 7 years to use it for pollinating blueberries. This year we discovered a mite population on those bees. This is a different mite called Chaetodactylus crombini. And absolutely none of the hundreds and hundreds of bees that we have in tubes are able to fly out of those tubes. They are completely overwhelmed by huge populations of these mites. So we've got two mites that we're worrying about right here in West Virginia. And Eric, I echo what Eric says. I've got a notepad here. Whenever Eric's speaking, I take notes. He's an excellent source of information and knowledge about every aspect of beekeeping. You're lucky to have him there in California.
Aye, that we are. And we're lucky to have both of you on the food chain today. Let me ask you this. We understand that with respect to domesticated bees, that it's quite an industry here in California. We understand that beekeepers from as far away as Pennsylvania bring their bees out to California, and they get as much as $200 a hive to for pollination. That's quite an industry, right, Eric?
Well, the one crop that requires an awful lot of bees in one place at one time is the almond crop.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years ago, we were short on bees, and the almond growers didn't want that to happen again. So a year ago, they upped the price significantly on their pollination. But I don't think too many people got $200 this year. Some may have, but I think it bounced around the $140, $150 range, which is still sounds like an awful lot of money. But recently, there has been so much things that the beekeepers have to do to fight mites. Sometimes the food hasn't been available the way it should be, and they tried to, we give them artificial pollen, if you want to call it that. We call it pollen substitute and sugar syrup, trying to keep them going when the food isn't there. And all this extra work now that has to be put in, that $140 gets eaten up pretty quickly just trying to maintain the hive.
Let's talk about, is it indeed the season of the dying bees? You know, we've heard a lot lately about the missing bees. We have to go to break right now, but is it really, are we really going through this collapse of the bee colonies? Are we really losing them to the extent to which we're being led to believe? Eric?
Well, yes, there's been an abnormal die-off of honeybees starting apparently late last summer and going right through the winter. And I guess, from what I've heard, occasional individuals are still kind of having a problem with it right now. So something is going on out there.
And we understand that some beekeepers are losing up to 80 to 90% of their beehives. So we're going to try to figure out where those bees are going. And of course, like Einstein said, if we lose our bees, boy, we're all in deep doo-doo. Welcome to the Food Chain. Michael Olson here today. We're talking the disappearing honeybees. We've got Dr. Eric Musson, who is the apiculturist for the University of California, Davis. We have Dr. Jim Amrine, who is the entomologist from West Virginia University. We're talking Michael Coastal Bees with you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back, please do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. We're talking about the disappearing bees of 2007. It's spring, and, you know, bees should be out doing their thing, but a lot of them are dying and just flying off from the colony and disappearing. They call it colony collapse. Disorder, colony collapse disorder. Ooh, that's kind of an ominous thing. Why should we city people care? Well, I guess Albert Einstein put it pretty succinctly. He says, without the honeybee, we've got 4 years, and there will be nothing left for us to eat. Do you think that's a possibility? Curious to hear what you have to say. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking bees with the bee people themselves. We have Dr. Eric Musson, who's a bee man from UC Davis, which is bee central this time of year. People from all over the United States bring their bees to their commercial bees to California to help pollinate the crops out here, especially the almond crop, which is almost totally dependent upon domestic bees. But it's not just almonds, it's 100 different crops. So how bad is colony collapse disorder? We heard that some beekeepers are losing 80 to 90% of their bees. Is that true, Eric?
Yes, that's true. That's happened to some individuals. But interestingly, sometimes a neighbor not too far away doesn't seem to have this problem. So that makes it very perplexing as well.
It's perplexing. Are we seeing the same thing on the other side of the country, Dr. Jim Amrine?
Yes. In this article on Der Spiegel, they quote several authorities saying about 70% of the colonies have died since November.
Now, is this just in the United States or is this around the world? We're talking about Der Spiegel magazine.
This is the eastern United States, but they say there in Germany they've lost 25% of their colonies.
So this is something that's going on all throughout the world.
Worldwide.
Worldwide. What is causing it, Dr. Musson?
I wish we knew.
We knew. We don't know.
Yeah. We this is the royal we now.
Mm-hmm.
We, meaning researchers from the USDA lab in Beltsville, Maryland, from Penn State University, University of Illinois, North Carolina State University, and the University of Montana, plus, I guess, Florida State Department of Agriculture and the Pennsylvania State Department of Agriculture. All those entities have been collecting samples, bringing them back to the lab, and checking for everything that they're creativity can suggest might be a problem, from mm-hmm. chemicals to diseases to...
Well, let me read the list that I've collected in just a few minutes of looking around. Weather, varroa mites, pollution from Chinese smokestacks, genetically engineered pollen, lack of nectar in flowers. Which do you think would be the most likely in your book?
You're asking me?
Yep.
Okay.
You're the man. You're Dr. B.
Stumbling around there in the back of my mind, I still think that malnutrition is important in this. It's not the only thing, but I think it is important. And it's important to the bees because they have a diet that requires a mix of quality pollen
mm-hmm.
in order for them to be healthy in order for them to rear their brood, in order for them to feed the queen enough food that she can lay 1,000 eggs a day during the summertime every day. That's a lot of food.
Right.
And you have to have good, nutritious food. And if the weather isn't playing the game right, it puts a stress on the plants. And then under those circumstances, sometimes the plants don't do such a good job of producing the kind of pollen
producing
that we need.
Nectar. Well, let me ask you this, and this is something I've always wondered about. If you have a prolonged winter, if you have an especially cold spring, you're feeding, essentially, you're feeding the bees, the domestic bees at any rate, you're feeding them sugar water. And from what we've learned about sugar recently, and with respect to sugar diabetes, etc., that can't possibly be a very nutritious diet for bees to live on for an extended period of time, can it?
No, it's not nutritious from the standpoint of providing any much of anything else other than a little bit of energy. But we have found in laboratory tests that sucrose syrup will keep bees healthy longer than feeding them diluted honey.
Interesting.
Say, Michael, could I...
Go ahead. Okay, Dr. Amrine, weather, varroa mites, Chinese pollution, genetically engineered pollen, lack of nectar in flowers. What do you think?
Here in West Virginia, when we have the problems, it's almost always varroa mites.
Varroa mites.
And I could tell you about the research I've been doing in Florida for the last 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
a year ago, I was called by commercial beekeeper David Webb. He was down to below 300 colonies, and they were sick and dying out, and nothing would help them. And so they asked if we would apply for a grant and go to Florida and do some research. And my team is myself and Bob Knoll and also David Webb. So we began work in Florida, and the first thing we did was feed the bees honeybee healthy mixed with sugar syrup.
Honeybee healthy mixed with sugar syrup.
And that is two essential oils from spearmint oil and lemongrass oil.
Mm-hmm.
That is mixed with the sugar, and I don't know why, but somehow this seems to reverse immune problems that bees have, problems of when they become susceptible to lots of diseases. This turns them around. We also use grease patties that have wintergreen, and that's another essential oil, and the wintergreen and the grease patties also seems to help the bees improve their health, and these bees resurged. And since then, David is up to over 600 colonies.
Huh.
And he harvested his honey in November and December, and he said it was the best bees he's had in 10 years and the best honey harvest he's had in 10 years.
So this is from the varroa mite, right?
And this, the varroa mite, when they're present in substantial numbers, they transmit viruses. These viruses really affect the overall system of the honeybee.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Musson, what exactly is a varroa mite?
Well, to you and me, it looks a little bit like the round oval-shaped Dungeness crab that we eat sometimes, except it doesn't have the big pair of pinchers on the front. It's got eight pairs of walking legs. It's about the size of a cat or a dog flea, which means you can see them, but they're pretty small.
Wow.
And they're an external parasite on honeybees. They'll live on adults when there's no brood, but the reproduction of the mite occurs on the pupae when they're in the cells.
So they're actually like clinging to a bee as it flies around?
Yes, they can cling to bees as they fly around. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, Dr. Amrine says he has a way of dealing with them. How do we deal with them out here in California?
Originally, there were products on the market that were sold to put into the hive that knocked the mites down and... Mm-hmm. I won't say it was benign to the bees. It didn't do them a whole lot of good either, but they survived through that. Eventually, the mites became resistant. So I guess some people would say you're on the insecticide treadmill. Mm-hmm. I guess there's another material coming on the market that's hopefully going to do what is going on. But if essential oils turn out to be the answer, that would be wonderful because these are much less toxic materials.
Right.
And if we can find the right ones to knock the mites off and not hurt the bees, that and we also are concerned, of course, about honey that's produced in those hives. We don't want that contaminated. And most of these essential oil things either are already found in honey, or if they happen to get into honey a little bit, it wouldn't matter that much anyway because they're not really toxic to people.
What about the notion of using these pesticides on bees? Does that pesticide then not get into our honey?
Well, it depends on which one it is, but most of the materials that are used for mite control are very bottled up in the wax, basically. They're fat-soluble products. They're not water-soluble products, and honey is a water product, mm-hmm. actually. I mean, it's a lot of sugar, but there's water in there, and it's a water solution. So these materials do not get into the honey in significant amounts. Yeah.
Wow.
But they do get into the wax.
Yeah.
I've heard that the world wax supply has polluted with some of these chemicals now for the next 60 years. You've probably seen that, haven't you, Eric?
What does that mean to we city people, though, that it's in the wax? I mean, we don't eat beeswax, do we?
We put the wax back in the bees in the form of foundation. Now, it's going to be locked up there. It's not going to cause any harm.
Mm-hmm.
But when you burn wax candles, then you might have a problem there of pesticide being released in the air that you breathe.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about genetic diversity among bees and whether all of the bees are from the same genetic family and what that means to our security. But folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're talking about bees. Einstein says, if we lose the bees, we got 4 years left. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, perhaps Einstein said it best, without bees, we've got 4 years left. Kind of hard to imagine for we city people who see bees flying from one flower to the next and think, huh, nice little critter, but boy, that little critter's an awfully important critter because it's responsible for over 100 of the crops that we cultivate and eat for our food, and some say the most important third of every bite that we eat comes from bees. Dr. Musson, does what Einstein say make sense to you? Do you believe that it's actually true that without bees we'd have 4 years left?
I hope we never have to try that out to find out. There are a number of things that are consumed by people that don't rely on honeybee pollination. But it would certainly change our diets an awful lot. I'm not convinced that we would necessarily all just die off, but things would certainly change.
Dr. Amrine, what do you think?
I agree with Eric. Here in West Virginia, the bees are valuable at pollinating a lot of the wildlife that we have, wild plants,
mm-hmm.
and it benefits the wildlife. But if you go around the state of West Virginia today, there I'd say about one-third of the state, you'd never see a honeybee. There are bumblebees and many other wild bees. I think maybe Einstein was saying if all bees disappeared,
mm-hmm.
He didn't really say honeybees.
Well, let's get.
Then we really would be in a jam.
That leads us to our next question, which is, of course, the whole notion of genetic diversity. Are all of these honeybees, these domestic workers that we have, colonized brought under the rain, as it were, are they all of the same species, or the same genetic strain, Dr. Musson?
Well, yes. Well, let's start. They're all the same species, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then there are, call them races, call them subspecies, call them whatever you want. They're geographically isolated sets of populations that have been there for a long time now and are differentiated from each other. And we have imported from Europe many of those different strains, and we like the so-called Italian bee, I guess, the best, and that's the predominant strain that's here, but there are others, and there were some bees that were recently brought in from Yugoslavia and Russia by the USDA. So are
all of them dying off?
Somebody said they didn't think the Russian bees were, but I don't know for sure. Steve Shepard, a researcher up at Washington State University, 20 years ago, took a look at the genetics of the bees in California and the Gulf Coast states, because that's where the queen breeders do their business and sell queens to everybody else in the country. And recently they ran that test again, and they have found that it appears as though somewhat there's what they call a bottleneck. In other words, the genes have kind of shrunk down. The gene pool is a little bit smaller, but not as significantly smaller than he thought maybe it was going to be. And there are individuals who would like to bring some more material from Europe into the United States to kind of reinvigorate our bees and maybe get a little bit more diversity into the gene pool. But it doesn't look as though we're in terrible shape.
Okay. Anything to add with that, Dr. Amrine?
I agree completely with Eric. We are in trouble genetically. And if our queen breeders, these are beekeepers in the South especially that produce queens for the rest of us around the country, if they are suffering the same losses that everyone else is suffering, then that genetic gene pool is really going to shrink. Now, we have an interesting bee in the southern part of the state country, the Africanized honeybee. It represents a very strong genetic source from outside of the North America.
Which is
I'm not sure you want to spread that around. Do we, Eric?
Well, that's one of the questions we have on the table. Are Africanized bees susceptible to this colony die-off? Are we seeing the same thing happening with the Africanized bees as we are the domestic bees?
Well, in California, we don't pay too much attention to what Africanized bees are doing because we're still trying to not keep them in our boxes.
Right.
But there are beekeepers in Arizona that keep them, and I haven't heard anything coming out of Arizona that there's been any problem with this disorder.
Huh.
The same way with Texas. They've learned to work with the bee in Texas as well.
So they're incorporating this Africanized bee into the food chain, as it were, right?
Well, in some cases, they really don't have much of a choice.
Sorry.
Because Africanized honeybees are much more competitive than our bees are under certain circumstances. And out in the desert regions of portions of Arizona and whatnot, the Africanized bee can make it, and the European bees don't do very well there at all. So if you wanted to stay in the bee business out there, you more or less allowed nature to take its course, and you end up with Africanized bees in your boxes.
So you learn to live with them and work with them.
Yeah, they're different, but you can manage them.
And we're not seeing the die-off that we are with the European bee then.
Well, I can't say that for sure, but I haven't heard of it.
Dr. Armine, have you heard anything?
I wouldn't say that either. The Africanized bees reached Texas in 1990, and I kept waiting for them to start going into Louisiana, Mississippi, and right on up into New Orleans, St. Louis and up to Mississippi, but they never did. I think once they get varroa mites, I think they get the viruses, and they become weakened, and they lose their ability to navigate. And remember, they are a tropical bee, and they just don't make enough honey to get through winter. So when they had a winter like this year in Texas with lots of ice storms, with not enough honey to keep them going, that energy is also heat for the bees, then they probably, a lot of them died out. They may have hit a big-time low for them in Texas this year.
Huh. Okay, when we get back, I'd like to talk about why some beekeepers are losing a lot of their colonies, while other beekeepers are not losing any. And as Dr. Musson said earlier, they could be neighbors. So what on earth is this telling us about the bee die-off? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking the disappearing bees of 2007 with Dr. Eric Musson from the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Jim Amrine from the West Virginia University, two of the nation's leading bee people, and we're fortunate to have them with us today. Curious to hear what you have to think about the bees. Do you really believe what Einstein said, that if we lose our honeybees, we have about 4 years left? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Colony collapse disorder. Wow. Sounds kind of like acquired immune deficiency, does it not? Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking of bees, or the disappearing bees of 2007. We've got Dr. Eric Musson from the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Jim Amrine from the West Virginia University, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 are the phone numbers today. And we're talking about why the bees are disappearing. Why is it that some beekeepers are having a lot of trouble and some beekeepers are having almost no trouble? I talked with a beekeeper from Montana who has his hives out here in California, pollinating the almond crop, or whatever you happen to call it these days. And he said, having no trouble at all. Why is that, Dr. Musson, that some beekeepers are losing all of their hives, and or 90% of their hives, and some beekeepers are losing almost none of their hives?
Well, that's very difficult to say. Obviously, no two beekeepers keep their bees exactly the same way. No two apiary locations, if they're very, very far apart from each other, get exactly the same environmental conditions. And you could talk to that same beekeeper and ask, have you had your apiaries spread out over a rather large area in a state somewhere hoping to get honey, and it rained over on the east side, but it was really dry over on the west side. So you can guess, you got a pretty good honey crop on the east side, but on the west side you didn't get much of anything. So you wouldn't anticipate that the bees from the east side would have as much trouble then dealing with going through the winter and whatnot, and probably wouldn't have the collapse disorder where perhaps some of the ones on the west side that weren't well fed might have a difficult time getting through the winter and just might collapse.
Mm-hmm. So you're really sticking to the nutrition, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm biased. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. Dr. Amrine, what about you?
I agree with the history of the beehives and the nutrition. Mm-hmm. And they may have been feeding on some plants like maybe water mint that grows down along a river somewhere.
And you're really sticking to the essential oils, aren't you?
Well, the plants make essential oils, and why do they make them? I mean, it costs the plant energy to make those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps defend them against various pests and diseases, and maybe we can just redirect this towards helping the honeybee.
What are we going to do to protect the honeybee? Dr. Musson, that's probably, if you have a job description, that would be it, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm more or less responsible for these 500,000 colonies out here in California. And at the moment, I'm not doing too well.
You're doing wonderful, Eric. Let me tell the beekeepers that you are the right guy in the right job and that you're going to help them out. We'll find that some of us working together will find a way to get this problem taken care of.
Dr. Musson, there was a similar occurrence in the 1960s. I forget what it was called, but there was a big die-off of bees in the 1960s. Was that not true?
Apparently, this is a periodic thing. I looked at some...
Hello? Goodness, did we lose him?
Didn't lose me, but I was a little bit surprised. No, something else came over my phone. Maybe you didn't hear it. But anyway, I asked the question again. I'm sorry. It really jolted me.
In the 1960s, we have ghosts here at the station,
so that's what happened. Okay.
In the 1960s, there was another big die-off of bees.
Right.
And was it the same kind of colony collapse disorder? It was called something else then, but was it the same kind of thing?
Is it very, very similar. According to one of the researchers that looked at a 1965 paper on that, he said you could just take that 1965 paper and use it right now, and it would exactly describe what's going on again. And apparently, like I said, 1890 or something like that, they saw it the first time. So this appears to be something that
kind of like an ill wind that blows
up. You know, I just haven't got really any idea of what's going on, and. Yeah, it's very, very perplexing. I do know one thing, though, since I'm the guy who thinks that food is really important in this, we still don't have available to us what we'll call an artificial feed, if you want to call it that, but it's not pollen, okay, that we can feed to the bees, and they will go generation after generation, if you will, just go on brood-rearing and the bees doing well and all that sort of thing. We haven't got one of those yet, and I think that's really a critical place where we have to do some research and see if we can get some kind of a better food. Now, I know the Tucson lab in Arizona has been working on this for a long time, and they did get a diet that acted pretty much in that way, but the materials that went into it were so expensive that no beekeeper could afford it.
Right.
So
right.
That's the trick here, is to try to find the components that we can afford that would give us food that would actually displace or replace pollens if they weren't available.
Isn't that the rub here when it gets right down to it? I mean, the ideal food to feed bees in the off season or in the winter would be honey.
Well, they need more than honey. They also eat their pollen, and they need proteins and vitamins and minerals mm-hmm. during the winter too. So I mean that portion of the diet, they're not eating very much of it because they're not feeding brood, but they have to keep eating it all the time. It's critical. Just like you and I, we can kind of goof off for a while on
junk food,
sugar water if we want to, yeah. but we can't do that very long.
Or pay the consequences.
Yeah.
Dr. Jim Amrine, what do you think would be the ideal food?
I again agree with Eric. There's a lot of research that needs to be done in that line.
You know, there's a lot
Try
of
to
parallels
keep it cheap,
between
you know, for the beekeepers. But I was going to say too that if you have a failing immune system, and that seems to be a big part of this equation, the best diet in the world is not going to save you. You've got to get your immune system back on track.
And do you think it's essential oils that can help do that?
We see it when we use it. Viruses clear up. We clear up things like sac brood goes away, and we see other ailments just kind of go by the wayside.
You know, there seems to be some parallels here between bee nutrition and human nutrition, or am I just making all of this up, Dr. Musson?
Actually, the similarities are closer than we might think. The amino acids, the 10 essential amino acids mm-hmm. that we need, they need. They can't make their own cholesterol, so they have to get that from pollen. But other than that, our diets are surprisingly similar in the needs, but we get them from very different places. They're not meat eaters. We get a lot of our, well, not all of our people are meat eaters either, but
right.
Many of us are, and we get our protein from different sources. But their diet's pretty similar to ours.
Dr. Amrine?
You know, they get most of the nutrients from their pollen. And if you have good pollen sources out there, you should have no trouble with nutrition. And maybe we should concentrate on making sure there's abundant, very nutritious pollen nearby our bees so that they have no problem getting the highest quality food.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to ask both of the doctors what we can do to help the honeybee, because the honeybee is obviously doing a lot to help us. Or as Dr. Einstein would say, no honeybee, no us. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking the disappearing honeybee of 2007. We're going to wrap up the program when we get back. So if you have a quick question you want to get in, now's the time to do it. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will be right back. Well, folks, what do you think? Do you think we can save the honeybee? I think we probably should save the honeybee, because the honeybee is doing its part to certainly save us, providing up to one-third of the food that you and I eat, and some would say the best one-third. So when we see the bee in trouble, as we see the bee in trouble this year, we're going to have to do what we can to save the bee, and we have a couple of guys here who are really doing their part to help us out. Dr. Eric Musson, Dr. Bee himself from the University of California, Davis, and also Dr. Jim Amrine, who's an entomologist from West Virginia University. And let's see, we have Lynn on the line. Lynn, are you?
Hi, Michael.
Well, hi, Lynn. This is Lynn Batazzo, the honeybee lady, the opera-singing honeybee lady from San Martin, California. Welcome to The Food Chain.
Did you have to say that, Michael?
Always.
Hi, Liam.
Okay, thank you, first of all, for having these two gentlemen on. I have a question to Dr. Eric.
Sure.
Dr. Eric, do you think that possibly these beekeepers that are not having problems are using the medication more often than is indicated? Not allowing the mite in. I'm on my way to Santa Barbara to check my bees, but I just wanted to ask them this.
Okay. Yes.
Are they overusing pesticides?
I don't know if she means overusing them, but the question is, do the beekeepers use whatever materials and however often they need to use it in order to keep the mites under control, and are the ones that are doing that having better luck than others? And I would say it's sort of a mixed bag. Some of the people.
That's not my question. Okay, let's say you use it every 20, that you're using it more often than you should. like you finish a series of 20 days and you go back on it again?
Yeah.
So what's happening is the bees never really get out of the medication phase, so the honey's getting contaminated.
Well, actually, the beekeepers that are doing things that are not quite regular don't tend to have treatments in there all the time. What they tend to do is they're treating about the same time they used to when their original chemicals worked, but they're treating with different things.
Okay.
They're not
so
treating all.
Excuse me. So therefore, like if we go to the humans who are using antibiotics on a continuous basis, when they get in really big trouble, then it's not going to work, and it's the same thing. It's lowering the immune system of the bees.
Well, I don't know if the chemicals that are used in humans lower their immune system. What normally happens is, especially if we have infections or parasites or whatever, if we keep using the same material, particularly if we never quit using it, you'll develop resistance. You'll select for the organisms, the bad organisms that are resistant to what you're doing, and they'll just come right through it like it's not there.
Okay. Now to the specialist from West Virginia. You agree with Eric that it's building up the immune system. So what do you suggest aside from having healthy pollen?
Well,
thank you, Lynn.
We've been working since 95, 96, using essential oils to help our bees overcome these problems. And I don't know if I can give you my email address.
Sure. Do it quickly, though. We're almost out of time.
Okay, it's jamrine at WVU.edu.
Mm-hmm.
Send me an email and I can send you information about what we've been doing in our research. But trying to keep the bees healthy, we need to correct their immune system and make sure they have nutritious diets. We can make healthy bees.
Dr.
But we need to work together.
Dr. Musson, what do we need to do to get healthy bees?
In my opinion, hope for better weather, and maybe if there's something peculiar going on out there, hope that these researchers find out what it is, because generally if we find out what's wrong, we can find some way to fix it.
Okay, folks, thank you so much. And right at the end of the program, we had about a zillion phone calls, so sorry I'm not able to get to you. We're out of time. Thank you, Dr. Musson. Thank you, Dr. Amrine, and thank you all for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.